On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we've all heard of WordPress, and one of the best attributes of it is its plugin model. Well, it seems that it might be its weakest link as well. We all know that our users are sometimes our weakest link, and they have their own risky security habits. Well, you might be surprised to know, so do some security pros. Curtis takes us through their habits, plus Brian McHenry, Curtis, and I go through some ideas on how to correct those habits. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech. Episode 381, recorded February 21st, 2020. Grand Theft Tesla. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a challenge, but there's one place you can go where hiring is fast and easy. That place is ZipRecruiter, where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Twyatt. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yes, it's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/enterprise. And by LastPass. Reused passwords are compromising the security of businesses worldwide. LastPass will ensure that your employees are using passwords securely by generating strong passwords for them. Visit lastpass.com/twit to learn more. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field. And let's start with our very own favorite enterprise and security journalist, starting with our Mr. Security himself. I guess you could say Mr. Curtis Franklin. He is the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, is always amazing to see you, my friend. Looks like you are gearing up for RSA. Is that right?
Absolutely. I've got a couple more days here in the swamp, and then I'm off to the city by the bay, where I am just going to be in wall-to-wall meetings from the time I hit the ground until I finally am wheels up a week later. Lots of great stories happening. I've got a bunch of killer interviews lined up, and as well as some interesting meetings. So I'm looking forward to bringing all of that to both my readers at Dark Reading and the Twyatt Riot here in the coming weeks.
I'm looking forward to it as well. Well, speaking of security experts, we have the return of Mr. Brian McHenry, Director of Global Security Solutions over there at F5 Networks. Bam. Happy New Year, my friend. It's great to have you back here on Twyatt.
It's great to be back. And, I was starting to get worried that it might not be welcome back if I kept delaying much longer.
Well, we will always welcome you back. But we actually want to know what's been going on. Maybe give us a quick summary if you can.
Well, you may have heard, if you follow F5, my employer, we acquired a little company called Shape Security for the tidy sum of $1 billion. Really excited about Shape. Been involved with the research and due diligence process since the very beginning last summer. And I got to say that I've learned a lot about machine learning, artificial intelligence, and how to detect humans versus illegitimate users on web applications over the last several months. And we're excited to bring a combined application security solution out to every F5 and Shape customer.
Thank you guys for being here. Well, guys, we've had a really busy week in security enterprise news. We've all heard of WordPress, and one of its best attributes is its plugin model. Well, it seems that it might be the point of weakness as well. We'll get into all that. Now, we all know our users are sometimes our weakest link, and they have their own security bad habits. Well, you might be surprised to know, so do some of the security pros out there. Curtis is going to take us through it and what it looks like from the enterprise and IT world perspective. But before we get into all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, you like when you actually use your mobile phone for directions, you must like that for, searching different places, using it for different functions. And you like the fact that your carrier sells your location data too, right? I love it. Of course, it makes me feel like I have a big brother. Well, according to the FCC, they've been conducting an almost two-year investigation onto the unauthorized sale of consumers' phone location data. That's right. And it seems they now have a pretty good idea of the scale of the problem. Now, it's apparent in apparent violations of the Communications Act, the country's major wireless carriers, which actually include AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile, have been accused of repeatedly violating their customers' privacy by disclosing their location data to so-called location aggregators. Now, those aggregators sold the data they acquired to, among others, bail bond agents, various law enforcement entities, reporters, and others. Now, what sparked the FCC investigations? Well, it was prompted by a letter from the Senator Ron Wyden in May 2018, which coincided with the New York Times investigation that drew national attention to the abuse of location data by the U.S. law enforcement and prison officials. Now, at the center of the investigation was Securus Technologies, a major provider of correctional facility phone and services, was found to be providing law enforcement with what we call unrestricted access to location data. Now, Securus purchased the data from which law enforcement officers would invariably require a warrant directly from major wireless carriers. In fact, last year, Motherboard actually published a series of articles describing the case where a bounty hunter actually paid $300 to put a trace on a cell phone. Now, the coordinates provided proved to be accurate up to a quarter mile. And in this case, it actually belonged to a reporter. Now, the FCC has not fully disclosed exactly which carriers will be accused and pulled into litigation, but we do know that once liability can be established by the commission, it will become public. Now, last May, major carriers, including T-Mobile, AT&T, and Sprint, said that they have ceased or at least significantly curtailed the sale of customers' location data. Millions and millions of Americans use a wireless device every day and didn't sign up for the surveillance of their data. Now, what does all this investigation and data mean? It means that regulations will soon come in the form of penalties, not only monetary, but trust as well.
Well, popular document management apps are putting user data at risk. Dozens of file management apps published by a popular operator of an online document management system do not encrypt file transfers to and from user devices, potentially exposing those users' data. Mobile security firm Wandera, which discovered the issue, described it as impacting 23 of 29 Comet Docs apps on Apple's App Store. Four of the remaining apps didn't convert files as claimed, and the other two were not file conversion apps at all. A random sampling of 31 Android versions of the same apps that Comet Docs has published on Google's official Play Store showed them to be leaking private files as well. Now, Comet Docs bills itself as a provider of apps that allow mobile device users to convert PDF documents into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, AutoCAD, HTML, and other formats. The company claims that its apps can be used to create PDF documents from a variety of other formats, including rarely used ones such as Publisher and XPS. Wandera said it had notified Comet Docs three times between December 2019 and January 2020 about the issue, but has so far not received a response. These apps are an example of the risks organizations face when they allow employees to use unmanaged mobile devices and non-vetted apps for work-related purposes.
Ring makes two-factor sign-in mandatory for its video doorbells and security cameras. The security of smart home devices has been top of mind for many, and security cameras have been the target of many botnet building attacks. For the most part, older web-based security cameras have been the target of such attacks and exploits. However, one of the newest and most popular devices, the Ring video doorbell, became subject to compromise when reports began surfacing of some pretty terrifying experiences back in December of last year. Now, in response to those compromises, Amazon, owner of Ring, has made two-factor authentication mandatory for all Ring customers. This announcement also includes general security advice about password reuse and maintaining extra security on your mobile phone account, as the second factor is delivered via SMS text messages. While mandating two-factor authentication seems like a reasonable response, it seems to gloss over the fact that Amazon and Ring weren't able to institute better native security controls to defeat the credential stuffing attacks used to take over Ring user accounts. Credential stuffing works by taking username and password combinations from previous breaches on other sites and services and attempting to log into new sites and services such as Rings, where users may have used those same credentials, aka reused passwords. Through scripting and browser automation, among other techniques, it's become possible for even an individual attacker to launch difficult-to-detect mass-scale attempts to reuse or quote-unquote stuff credentials. The failure here wasn't in bad IoT device firmware, as we so often find, but in poor controls for detecting these automated credential stuffing attacks and differentiating legitimate versus illegitimate users. Well, this may seem like a very difficult problem to solve, and it is. The term credential stuffing has been around for years, and large banks have been fighting this type of fraud with varying degrees of success for quite some time. And yet, you'd imagine that parent company Amazon would surely have faced this same problem. However, Ring itself has been unable to respond to this well-known attack except to mandate more security responsibility on their users.
It was the movie Live Free, Die Hard, I think, that hackers got in and hacked a natural gas plant. A lot of us thought only in the movies, right? Well, according to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, an unidentified ransomware strain forced the shutdown of a natural gas pipeline for almost 2 days. Now, thank goodness that this did not turn out to be like Bruce Willis's movie, because nothing actually blew up here. But the attackers, whoever they might be, never got control of the facility's operations. The human-machine interfaces that read and control the facility's operations were successfully yanked offline, and geographically separate system controls was able to keep an eye on operations, though it isn't instrumental in actually controlling them. Now, you may be interested, where was this mysterious attack and where did it go down? Well, the alert issued by the Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, the CISA, didn't say where the affected natural gas compression facility was located, but it instead stuck to summarizing the attack and provided technical guidance for our other critical infrastructure operators so they can gird themselves again, actually protect themselves against similar attacks as well. Now, whoever the attacker was, they launched a successful spear phishing attack, which enabled them to gain initial access to the facility's IT network before pivoting to its operational technology network. Now, the OT network are where hardware and software for monitoring and or control physical devices, processes, and events reside. Now, some examples are SCADA industrial control systems, programmable logic controllers, or PLCs, and HMIs. Now, after the attacker got their hands on both the IT and OT networks, they deployed what CISA actually calls our commodity ransomware, encrypting data on both networks. Now, staff lost access to the HMIs, data historians, and polling services. For years, DHS has been warning that enemy nations might be ready to disrupt U.S. energy utilities, although we don't know which malware strain was involved in this week's advisory. This came in 2 weeks after researchers from industrial cybersecurity firm Dragos reported that a ransomware strain known as ECANS, or EKNS, had tampered with industrial control systems used by gas facilities and other critical infrastructure. If fiction movies have taught us anything, there may be some truth to the creativity of the bad guys.
Well, 44% of security threats are now starting in or using the cloud. A new Netskope study has found that 44% of security threats use cloud services in one or more stages of the kill chain. Attackers are targeting popular cloud apps and services to exploit the growing trust in community-used enterprise platforms with Microsoft Office 365 for Business, Box, Google Drive, Microsoft Azure, and GitHub, the most targeted cloud apps. According to the study, the average business uses 2,145 cloud services and apps, and the most popular app categories are cloud storage, collaboration, webmail, consumer, and social media. Now, the most popular apps overall are Google Drive, YouTube, Microsoft Office 365 for Business, Facebook, Gmail, SharePoint, Outlook, Twitter, Amazon S3, and LinkedIn. Netskope researchers noted the migration of private apps and data to the cloud, more remote work, and increased use of public cloud apps as reasons for the increased use of the cloud in attacks. At least 20% of enterprise users move data laterally between cloud apps, Netskope found, and more than half of data privacy violations come from cloud storage, collaboration, and webmail. Nearly 40% of the data that moves between cloud apps is sensitive, and lateral movement spans 2,481 cloud services and apps. The most common movement is between cloud storage services, storage and collaboration tools, cloud storage and webmail, and cloud storage and customer relationship management systems.
Jailbreaking Teslas? Well, Tesla may be best known as a car company, but at its roots, it's probably better to think of them as a software company. It is so much a software company that your vehicle has features on it that can't reach unless you unlock them by paying Tesla more money. Almost sounds like a game, doesn't it? It seems to be the theme of today's devices and services. You get a baseline device or service, but it's not as enjoyable or sometimes even unusable unless you get the add-ons. To relate this back to Tesla, for example, to get autopilot, self-driving features, you need to pay an extra $8,000. It's been reported that some people who purchased a used vehicle that was originally purchased with that package, where any record of that purchase was lost, and Tesla revoked the feature from the car. This is Tesla's policy. No record of an upgrade. They roll back the feature on your vehicle. Well, the market has come up with a solution that Tesla will most likely plug up soon enough. Tesla functions more like a consumer electronics company than traditional vehicles. Similar to smartphones and laptops, the cars receive software updates over the air that affect everything from the infotainment system to the car's road performance and range. For example, Teslas with dual motors are sold with an optional performance package that, among other physical features like a different interior, improves acceleration and top speed for an extra $8,000 to $20,000 depending on the model. While every car company offers different trim levels that vary the car styling and performance, Tesla is the only car company that we know of that remotely disables those performance features via a software update. Few other automakers even offer over-the-air updates, and those that do are limited to things like the infotainment system and associated apps. The Model X performance package costs $20,000 more than the standard version. So, in effect, Tesla remotely disabled a performance upgrade that, on its own, costs as much as a brand new car. This is where jailbreaking steps in. If the car originally had supercharging when sold and has no high voltage safety issues, it can be turned back on. That means you'll have to weigh the benefits of ludicrous speed versus the conveniences and expenses of replacing a battery or control system in your cars in the year to come.
Historically, RSA's main focus was to provide risk, security, and fraud teams with the ability to manage digital risk. While Dell saw their value back in 2015 when it bought EMC for $67 billion, which actually included RSA. Now, this included the infamous RSA security conference held each year in San Francisco, which is actually coming up in a couple weeks here. But just on the horizon of the famous security conference, Dell has decided to sell RSA for the bargain price of $2.075 billion to a consortium of investors led by Symphony Technology Group. Other investors include Ontario Teachers Pension Plan Board and the ALP Invest Partners. Now, although Dell wasn't completely transparent what sparked the sale, but what it does seem was that Dell decided it was simply time to get some cash and jettison the veteran security company to go a bit more modern, as RSA's approach no longer aligned with Dell's company-wide security strategy. Now, according to Dell themselves, quote, "The strategies of RSA and Dell Technologies have evolved to address different business needs with different go-to-market models. The sale of RSA gives us greater flexibility to focus on an integrated innovation across Dell Technologies while allowing RSA to focus on its strategy." Now, in lighter news, this definitely won't be causing any hiccups in the announcements coming from the RSA conference at the end of this month. This will include such announcements as Microsoft Threat Protections GA, Microsoft 365 Insider Risk Management, and Microsoft 365 Communication Compliance. It will also include Farsight Security returns with another industry-first valuable real-time DNS intelligence data, as well as NetScout announcements as well, and more. I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about what's coming up soon. Now, if nothing else, the sale of RSA might allow more control over their strategy, and come 2021, we might see some serious pivoting. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have our bites. But before we get to bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a challenge, and Codable co-founder Gretchen Huebner discovered when she had trouble hiring a game artist to take her education tech company to the next level. That's why she went to ZipRecruiter. Why? Well, ZipRecruiter's technology finds people with the right experience, invites them to apply to your job. In fact, after posting her job on ZipRecruiter, Gretchen said she was honestly surprised at how quickly she was able to find a qualified applicant, and she hired a new game artist in less than just 2 weeks. Now, with results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Now, you know, it's not easy to hire the right employees for the job you need to fill. For me, for one posting and position, I actually can spend hundreds of hours looking through resumes, posts, and applications. I needed a tool that was effective and time-saving, and that was definitely ZipRecruiter. In fact, I found that ZipRecruiter finds candidates from places I've never recruited before, finding really unique and a diverse set of candidates visible to me. Now, see why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Twiet. That is ZipRecruiter.com/Twiet. ZipRecruiter.com/Twiet. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into this week's Bytes. Now, we all know about WordPress because it's almost 1/3 of the internet's traffic and people hit that site and sites like that. In fact, one of the big selling points of WordPress's platform are the plugins. But as we found, just with browser extensions and plugins, sometimes they actually more than meets the eye. Now, WordPress is a large, large target. Hackers are actively exploiting a really critical WordPress plugin vulnerability that allows them to completely wipe all website database and in some cases, seize complete control of the affected sites. Now, you might be interested in which plugin this might be. Well, the flaw is in the ThemeGrill demo importer installed on some 100,000 sites, and was disclosed over the weekend by website security company WebRx, which they reported the flaw under active exploit, which is almost 17,000 attacks blocked so far. Now, based on their report, some of the affected websites show a WordPress Hello World post. CC if you use this plugin and your web page hasn't been deleted yet, consider yourself lucky and remove the plugin. Yes, you do want to remove it. You don't want to just actually update it. Now, some of you may know that the Hello World message is the default placeholder displayed on WordPress's sites when the open source content management system is first installed or when it's wiped clean. Now, the ThemeGrill demo importer is used to automatically import other plugins available from the web development company ThemeGrill. Now, statistics from WordPress initially said that the importer plugin received 200,000 installations. More recently, the number has been revised down to 100,000, most likely because many of the websites opted to actually uninstall it. Now, the worst part is it seems that this vulnerability has been around and active for almost 3 years. That's right, 3 years. The bug stems from a failure to authenticate users before allowing them to carry out privileged administrative commands. Now, hackers can abuse this failure by sending web requests that contain especially crafted text strings. Now, I want to throw this over to Brian first, because first, platform targets are always big. Brian, you have an experience in this area of having platforms being targeted on a regular basis. Is this just the nature of popular platforms out there?
Yep. This is it, right? So, it's like people saying, well, you can't get a virus on a Mac. Well, that's not true. We know there are Mac viruses, but that myth persists because Macs for a long time were such a small percentage of the user base and the potential attack targets or attack surface that it didn't pay to develop viruses for a system. Yes, a Linux or Unix-based system, as we have with the FreeBSD-based OS X, is a little harder to develop a virus for. However, why spend that time when it's so much easier and so much more of a target-rich environment to develop viruses for Windows? And so it goes with WordPress and with Apache Struts, right? I think Apache Struts was averaging a serious, CVSS score 10 vulnerability like every 2 months for like 4 straight years for a while there. And we know the Struts vulnerability was used to compromise a bunch of websites. I mean, how many sites are running Apache Struts to integrate Java onto their Apache application server platform? So, yeah, this is absolutely the nature of things. And patching these things is hard. And that's why we have intermediate countermeasures like bot detection, looking for things that are scanning for these vulnerabilities, like web app firewalls, which enable us to patch, put a plug, a signature in a hole for a vulnerability while we work to patch the backend system or wait for a patch to become available. So, yeah, if you have a popular platform, it's going to get targeted. You know, the attackers and security researchers alike are going to look at these platforms, research where they have flaws, and try and either. To try to disclose them responsibly if you're a researcher, or if you're an attacker, exploit them for fun and profit.
Right. Now, Curtis, I want to throw this to you. Now, Bam brought up some good points about how platforms can make things better. But platforms are notorious here, right, for being exploited. And in fact, some companies like Apple have really kind of an iron fist around their platforms, and even they actually get some malicious code leaks in some of their applications. What do you think some of the next steps here are for platforms?
Well, I think that the next step depends heavily on exactly what the platform is like. For example, Apple is at this point the very definition of a closed platform. As you say, they keep an iron fist on the requirements for the add-ins, the requirements for applications, the requirements for any software that's listed on their store. They're very good at that. And as a rule, there are certain types of vulnerabilities that tend to be seen less often in software for Mac OS and iOS. WordPress, on the other hand, is an open source bit of software. It is a platform that is open source. And it has to be noted that WordPress itself tends to be pretty secure. The WordPress community is very good about getting patches and updates out whenever a vulnerability is found. The problem is this extensible nature of WordPress, all of the add-ins, all of the plugins, all of the extensions, which are much less heavily vetted than WordPress itself. And it's through these add-ins, plugins, and extra software that most of the attacks and breaches occur. So I think that what we need is greater scrutiny of open source projects and a greater sense that there are, in fact, owners of the software, whether it be the platform or the add-ins. It's that sense of ownership that's critical. And that's where we really need to have an encouraging atmosphere so that the people who are participating in these projects feel that it's in their best interest to feel like the owners of even open source software.
So, Bam, I want to throw this back to you because, again, very, very supportive and understand platforms here. Now, one thing I want to point out here, SQL injection has been around for a long time, and this particular vulnerability seems odd to me because it essentially means that they're not sanitizing their inputs. Why aren't platforms learning by now? What's going on here?
So I think, we have an issue of, again, what Kurt talks about is sort of the ecosystem around it. So it's not so much, again, we'll take the and Kurt's, mentioning Apple and their closed system, right? That's what Apple really got right in terms of, iOS is not inherently more secure than Android. What is more secure is having a really tightly controlled ecosystem. Think of apps in the App Store like the plugin ecosystem that WordPress has, right? Anybody can write a WordPress plugin, and anybody can make it available. What seems to be the challenge is, and I've managed WordPress sites before, in my free time. B-Sides New York was formerly on WordPress. And I can tell you that it's a daily job to kind of keep it patched and monitor things. And the plugins you use are what make it a really fantastic platform to publish a really professional looking site that does all sorts of neat things that you would associate with an army of web developers when it's just a guy like me who really doesn't know much about development at all. The challenge here is, I think, for WordPress is, do they have the people or the manpower to really start to vet the plugin ecosystem, right? Because for me, I could do that, right? I, as a security professional, as someone who has a lot of experience in IT, I could say, all right, this plugin is really well maintained. It gets patched frequently. It's used by a lot of people. And I have, you know, I can research whether it's got vulnerabilities. But for most folks that stand up a WordPress site, they're not going to do that. They're going to say, ah, this thing does the thing I need it to. And maybe one other person or two other people recommended it to me. And that'll be good enough. So time to remediate, whether it's open source or it's and time to, you know, really that boils down is time to deliver a patch. You know, some open source projects, you know, Apache is great about releasing patches very, very rapidly. There are other open source projects, and I'm not going to name names, but there are other open source projects that do a really crap job of responding with patches. And that's really where I think we have to ask, you know, WordPress to maybe start to vet its plugin ecosystem a little bit better if they want to be viewed as a secure platform. Because I would agree, I think, you know, WordPress in the early days, I think probably had some issues with time to remediate and have gotten really good at delivering patches in a timely fashion. However, their plugin ecosystem continues to bite them. And because of the way plugins work on that platform, it's very hard to limit their access to a way that makes makes it impossible to write a vulnerable plugin. So I think really where the onus has to be is to ask WordPress to say, hey, start clearing the trash out of, you know, the at least your officially sponsored plugin store, so that, you know, there's not the seeming endorsement of the security of a third party plugin.
Yeah, you know, Bam brings up a good point, Curtis. I want to throw this back to you because he's basically saying, hey, listen, WordPress, your time to remediate is pretty bad here, right? They haven't really pulled anything. What about accountability here? Like, should WordPress and other companies that are open source be held accountable for, you know, shipping these things, knowingly having these vulnerabilities, but not doing really anything about them since it's such an open source platform?
Well, for better or for worse, I think what we have is a situation where the invisible hand of the market tends to be the only real instrument for holding an organization responsible, whether that's a commercial organization or somebody doing an open source project. You know, we really don't have any kind of regulatory framework in place to hold companies responsible. And we've seen over time that courts have been unwilling to apply any sort of financial discipline on companies that might have taken a while to patch or remediate problems. So for better or for worse, I think that it's up to the customers to say, you know, you're not remediating. These things are being way too vulnerable for too long, and therefore I'm going to switch to something else. The problem then, of course, is what else is more secure, and how much is it going to cost to make the switch from one platform to another? And in a lot of cases, companies look at the options and decide that, vulnerable or not, it's better to stay with the devil you know.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, that does it for that bite. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the fact that, hey, we know that users are our weakest links sometimes in our systems. But in fact, you know what? Some of their habits are not so great, but we find out some of the IT pros' habits are not great as well. And Curtis is going to take us through some of those. But before we get to that, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Express. VPN. Now, we all know how VPNs protect your privacy and security online, right? Well, there's a lot of VPN providers out there, and you've probably heard a few of them. Now, some of you may have even used a VPN before. Now, I recommend brands to my listeners that I trust and I can actually use, and ExpressVPN is one of the best VPNs in the market. It really is. If you're concerned about privacy and security, ExpressVPN doesn't log your data. That's right. Many of the cheaper free VPNs make money by selling your data to other companies. Are you surprised? Well, so ExpressVPN developed a technology called Trust Server that makes it impossible for their servers to log any of your info. Now, speed is really important to me. I bet it's more important and really important to you as well. Now, many other VPNs slow your connection down or make your device sluggish. I've used ExpressVPN for some time, and my internet speeds are blazing fast. Now, when I travel, I can tell you I need to keep on to my TV series that are out there. That's where ExpressVPN unlocks my ability. Even when I connect to servers 1,000 miles away, I can still stream HD quality videos with zero lag. In fact, I was actually recently in Dubai, and I was able to get my Mandalorian fix over Disney Plus right from there. Now, what really sets ExpressVPN apart from other VPNs is how easy it actually is to use. You can just fire up the app and click on one button to connect. It's so easy, even your grandparents can use it. That's right. There are 100 VPNs out there, but ExpressVPN is super wicked fast. Now, VPNs are also only as good as their ease of use, and ExpressVPN is compatible with all of your devices, phones, media, consoles, smart TVs, and more. And so you can watch what you want on the go or on that big screen wherever you are now. Plus, you can get it working right with your router. Don't take my only word for it. We have Tech Radar, The Verge, CNET, and many other tech experts rating ExpressVPN the number one VPN in the world. So protect yourself with a VPN that I use and trust. Use my link, expressvpn.com/enterprise today, and get an extra 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/enterprise. Visit expressvpn.com/enterprise to learn more. And we thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, we all know that users are sometimes our weakest link, and they have their own security risky habits. But you might be actually surprised to know that so do the security pros. Curtis?
Cybersecurity professionals and the employees and consumers they serve all engage in risky security practices. Recent data shows password issues continue to plague users of all experience levels. Two-factor authentication is lagging, and mobile devices, well, they keep introducing new challenges. The State of Password and Authentication Security Behaviors Report, which was conducted by the Poneman Institute and commissioned by Yubico, which has in the past been a guest here on TWiET, polled over 2,500 IT security practitioners and more than 560 individual users to learn the habits of the security pros and how those habits compared to the habits of employees and customers. Larry Poneman, who conducted the research, said that we expect people who are in IT and IT security to be more security smart than the average users, but for the most part, he found that both groups are more similar than they are different. Now, that doesn't mean that they're identical. When asked about the increase in security and privacy concerns, security pros pointed to their higher concern for government surveillance, as well as more use of mobile devices and connected devices. Consumers, on the other hand, said they're most worried about their personal data, particularly medical records shared with third parties, followed by mobile devices and connected devices. Behavioral numbers between the two groups are much closer. 60% of professionals said they don't use two-factor authentication to protect personal accounts, compared with 64% of consumers who don't. Half of professionals reuse passwords across workplace accounts, compared with 39% of consumers. And roughly half of both groups sometimes or often share passwords with colleagues. After some sort of account takeover attack, 3/4 of consumers said they changed how they managed their passwords or protected their accounts, while only 65% of IT pros did the same. Further, individuals are more likely to use stronger passwords, make more frequent password changes, use unique passwords across multiple accounts, or start two-factor authentication use after a cyber attack. Now, the difference between the two are not just a tech mindset, the researchers explain. It goes back to the systems and processes of a large organization that makes it harder to make a technology switch by putting specific mandates on security practices. He found that businesses often adhere to policies created decades ago, and those who don't follow those old, out-of-date policies are out of compliance. The IT security pros, well, they often go along because they don't want to be seen as out of compliance, and there's no support in the organization for doing something newer or better. Now, one of the things that this found is that passwords are a hard habit for organizations to break and a hard habit for users to get right. People, they found, may not feel truly secure unless they have passwords, regardless of what other authentication methods are in place. Now, what are these other authentication methods that may be in place? Security pros reported the SMS codes, backup codes, and mobile authentication apps are the three main two-factor authentication methods they support or plan to support for customers. Now, despite their concern for personal data, only 49% of the consumers said that they have improved their account security with a layer of protection beyond their username and password, and only slightly more than half are willing to adopt new security techniques, even if they are easy to use and significantly increase security. Mobile devices are increasing security for some people, offering another authentication method. At the same time, they are offering a new attack vector and a new source of vulnerabilities for those users. Securing mobile devices across an organization can be very complex, especially as compared to securing laptops and desktops, because more people rely on mobile to communicate rather than simply using it as a computing platform. Most people, whether they're IT pros or end users, don't realize that the entire nervous system of an organization is based on the way people communicate, and mobile has become the foundation method of that. Now, I want to turn to my co-host and look at this and ask, first of all, and Bem, I'll go to you because you deal with security pros on a fairly regular basis. Does it surprise you to hear that security pros and the employees that they work with are largely the same in their practices, even if they differ in their concerns?
No, it's not surprising at all, because I'm a security pro and I'm guilty of all of the above. I think we have to drill down into what's actually the heart of the issue here, and it's that we're all human, right? And things that interfere with user experience, things that create friction, are things that we're not going to adopt unless we feel pain. So I'm not going to make my day-to-day experience using apps and websites more difficult if I don't have an acute pain, i.e. I haven't had my credentials stolen or my identity stolen. You know, those are the things that are going to drive me to change my behavior. And even then, my response is probably just change my password, right? I got a notice that this got hacked. Oh, change my password. I've got to say that, you know, the more I've gotten deep into some work around credential stuffing and researching how this is, you know, how all these many, many breaches are making it easy for password reuse to really bite you. And I've actually seen a number of my accounts get locked out because someone's trying to log into those accounts with reused passwords, almost certainly, right? That's inference on my part based on experience. But certainly I see evidence of it happening on my accounts. And so I've moved, you know, certainly moved in the direction of better behavior of late. But I got to say, one of the things that's made me move in that direction a little bit more aggressively is My adoption of the Apple ecosystem, and some will decry me for that. Some will applaud, you know, because it's a zealous sort of attitude. But you know, in that, as much as I use a MacBook, I use an iPhone. I've started, I tried to use Google's built-in password, Google Chrome's built-in password capabilities in terms of password generation and password management, which I found just unwieldy being on an Apple ecosystem. As I started to really dislike Google Chrome, I gave Safari another try, and I found that everything works really well together, right? So it's become really easy for me to generate unique passwords and use them in apps, use them on websites, and have them authenticated by Face ID or Touch ID. So really it wasn't, you know, yes, it was my concern, but really it was the ease of use coming along, because I never really got along too well with third-party password managers and their clunky browser plugins. That was just something, again, it wasn't easy enough for me. Now that I have something that's easy and works well for me, I've adopted better practices. And isn't that a surprise?
Well, you know, one of the things that I have talked about often is what I call the friction delta. Ideally, you want the friction for users to be as low as possible, while the friction for attackers is extreme. And Lou, I'd like to turn to you and ask, you know, as you think about things like user experience and the various second factor that can be used in authentication, have you seen a big difference in the kind of friction provided to the users by the various methods? And does that mean that from where you sit in application development, you feel like there are certain second factors that are perhaps more effective than others because they're more likely to be used?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think that, you know, there are a lot of, there's like an old saying that says the more annoying a security process is, the more secure it is. I don't think it's necessarily true. I've used a lot of different MFA or 2FA type systems in the past that have had very little impedance on my workflow. I'll give you an example. You know, these new kind of authenticator models, especially ones that are secured by biometrics to actually get the code. So not only do you have a password, but you also have the code, and the code's secured by authenticator, and that authenticator is secured by biometrics. And so you almost have a three-level, three-level or 3FA type security model there. And I'll tell you, to get set up on those authenticators is fairly simple. You know, whether it's scanning a QR code the first time you log in that, you know, generates the correct seed for your authenticator. And then you obviously log in, and then biometrics secures it from there. And that's actually pretty low impedance from a workflow perspective. And I think users like that. They'd like to be able to log into something and know that the whole security handshake that goes on behind the scenes is going to be almost transparent to them with just a little bit extra effort. But there's all other ones that are a little bit more annoying. For instance, I'm a big fan of YubiKey. I like to use it a lot. But sometimes, you know, having this physical thing that you have to carry along with, that it's not just your cell phone, because again, my cell phone tends to have the authenticator on it, can be annoying. It could be hey, where's my keys at? Where's the device at? It's not always stuck in my laptop because I need to be able to move around and authenticate in different areas. And so this physical median thing that's extra to my normal daily life can actually create a usability problem, especially if I don't have it and I can't log in. And so I would say, you know, these types of decisions made by software and service developers about what they're going to institute is definitely defined by usability, which is why a lot of them don't have it. You'll see that a lot of even banks today, they still have this extra security question they ask you, which is actually not relevant anymore, because a lot of times the same security questions are asked on multiple services. And so having just a password and that is not as secure anymore, and they don't have any additional security models. Like, give an example, US Bank doesn't have this kind of MFA model yet that I know of, at least, other than on their Android or iOS app. Their website doesn't have it. So I think that these systems need to start considering that, hey, maybe we'll add an extra piece into the workflow, make it a little harder for our users to kind of do it, but at least it'll be more secure. We might get some complaints about it, but at least we'll make it more secure and more reliable for our users. But in the same sense, it doesn't always have to be an extra pain. I think there's ways to make it easier and to make that kind of impedance real low.
Well, you're talking about low impedance, and a lot of people feel like SMS-based authentication is one, because as you point out, most of us have our phones with us all the time. Brian, I'd like to ask you, in terms of looking at different multi-factor authentication systems, what do you think about the SMS-based system? Do you think this is the ultimate goal, or do you see problems that we could have if we just turn everything over to the SMS-based authentication?
Yes. Thanks, Kurt. I think, yeah, there's a problem there, right? I love the authenticator models that Lou was talking about. Google Authenticator, Duo is another one. There's a bunch of really good services. Even Yahoo institutes like an authenticator model via their iPhone app or Android app. Those are really good models because there's some security. How you get access to those, and you can't social engineer your way to that. What we found is that with the SMS text-based model, if you're the subject to a targeted attack, say a spear phishing campaign, you're going to see the bad actors actually call your mobile provider and pretend to be you. And if you don't have additional security controls set up on your mobile account, now somebody can take over your SIM. It's basically called SIM hijacking, and intercept those text messages. And your two factor now is really no better than your reused password. So there's a lot of criticism around relying on only a SMS text base as the second factor. It's not a bad one in per se, right? Because there is a bit of you've got to be social engineered as a customer service person at the mobile operator. But the reality is, if that's the only option, then you're not providing a good enough option. It should be an option because that's the least friction. That's something that everybody has. You're not asking somebody to download an extra app. So certainly offer that option. But if I'm giving a relative or a friend advice about what type of two-factor to use, I'm saying, hey, if a company gives you an option to use a Google Authenticator on your phone, that's a great one. It's always in your pocket, like Lou said. Or if you're comfortable using a YubiKey or something like that, for somebody that's maybe a little more technical, that's a good option. But I think this reliance and certainly the message that's sent, to call back my own blip about the ring compromise and the mandate for two-factor, they mandate two-factor for all the users. Fine. You really, again, sort of papers over the core issue of what's going on there. But the two-factor they offer or mandate, and it's the only one they have, has serious security flaws, known security flaws, to the extent that they have advice in the announcement that says, hey, make sure you set a PIN with your mobile operator. Make sure you do some things to make sure that your phone number and your text can't be intercepted or sent to another device unbeknownst to you. So there's definitely some flaws in that model. It's okay. I'm not calling for, hey, don't use SMS text as two-factor. I use it a lot. But certainly if I'm a service provider of some sort, if I'm a bank, if I'm, whomever, I want to offer something more than just SMS two-factor. And there are a plethora of options as mentioned for two-factor that you can offer to the average consumer, that are fairly low friction, fairly pervasive, in terms of availability, and, are much more secure than SMS two-factor.
You bring up a bunch of points there, and I think one as well, when we talk about biometrics, there are too many companies that are looking at a biometric authentication method as the only authentication that's needed. And biometrics are not better if they are a single-factor authentication method because, as we know, anyone in the security industry knows, there really is not a solid biometric factor that has not been hacked, at least in the research level. Lou, before we close out on this, I've got to ask you tend to have your finger on the pulse of all kinds of technology. Do you see any sort of magic bullet technology out there, something that we're going to be able to use that will enable us to stop thinking about how good at security users are? Or do we have to wait for user 2.0 to really get past a lot of these problems?
I mean, it's all about education. I definitely think that user 2.0 is not coming anytime soon because security tends to just continue to evolve, as well as that the attackers continue to evolve over time. And so, you know, it doesn't matter what type of system you're using, there's always going to be found a vulnerability in that system. We always thought that SSL and HTTPS was invulnerable to attack and to potential vulnerabilities, right? But I think we found that that's not true. And so there's other things, like, for instance, MFAs. There are some vulnerabilities in MFAs, especially if people get a hold of your devices. And so these types of things will always have vulnerabilities. You're only, like I said, I will always say you're only as secure as your weakest link. Your weakest link is your users. And whether that 2.0 will come soon, you're always going to have an evolution, and there's going to be a need for 3.0 and 4.0 and releases. And that's the same thing for security. It's the same thing for services, the same thing for software. We just have to continue to evolve with it. Now, whether education will help with that, I think that's true. I think that if we continue to educate users, companies, organizations about the existing vulnerabilities, like we do here on Twyte, we try to educate you on what's going on around the market and around the globe around security things and security vulnerabilities, and there are some common ways to correct those things, and some of them could be educating your users, educating your user base, educating your organization about it. But some of them could be instituting more policy, more security services. But along the way, if you combine all of those, you will reduce the surface area, reduce the probability of getting attacked. And then you'll move on from there and something else will come out and you'll evolve. So I think, I think the evolution will never end. Will 2.0 really help? Probably not. But I will definitely agree that the industry will continue to evolve along with it. So we'll definitely see some new stuff coming up.
Very good. Well, this is the kind of thing that is going to keep going, because we are going to keep looking for better and better ways to authenticate users and make sure that only authorized individuals have access to data and systems. Until then, though, be sure to keep your passwords strong and frequently changed, unique to every account, and if you have the option for multi-factor authentication, by all means, use it. Well, Lou, we're going to keep chugging right on through. Let's take it back to you to move us to the next section of this magical time at Twyte.
Twyte and Twit. Thank you so much, Curtis. Well, speaking of good security and good security habits, we have to thank a great sponsor, and that's LastPass. Now, people have their favorite tool. Mine is definitely, it saves me time and money, and that's definitely LastPass. Not only it provides you ability to not to have a different password everywhere, it will generate passwords for you, unique passwords everywhere, and all you have to do is remember that master password. Now, you have a username and password for every site you go to, every site, especially the ones most important to you, your financial ones, your business sites, your social networks, your email, you name it. For me, it's 5 different banks. I have to generate and use a new password for every one of them. Do I remember them all the time? Definitely not. In fact, I don't want to stick it on sticky notes. I don't want to put it in my email in clear text or on my desk. I don't want to put it somewhere where somebody's going to find it, because that's just not smart, right? Well, you don't want to actually store them in plain text area. That's where LastPass comes in and saves us all. They automatically remember and fill passwords anytime, anywhere, on your computer, on your mobile device, really just anywhere. All you have to remember is that master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. Now, I got hooked on my desktop when I started using it in my browser and everywhere, but I also started using it on my mobile device as well, and it's Android and iOS integration is superb, and it definitely helps me be more secure. Now, there was a global security password security report that recently came out and revealed that some interesting findings of the trends in credential management, access, and authentication throughout business world. Now, did you know that employees have been known to reuse a password 13 times on average? 13 times. Now, 49% is the average security score of over 47,000 businesses already using LastPass. This means ongoing password reuse is hampering those scores. Now, LastPass helps solve these access and authentication challenges for business through unified password management, single sign-on, and multi-factor authentication. We just talked about all of this. This LastPass will help you with every one of those things. Now, manage password security with over 100 customizable policies. LastPass recently actually rolled out passwordless authentication options for employees so you can log into your work without typing a password at all. Now, they also offer a single sign-on portal with over 1,200 applications. Make sure that your employees are securely logging into different sites. Then they don't have to be – it actually doesn't have to be painful. But they don't have to have that impedance we just talked about. Get the LastPass browser extension and start solving your access and authentication challenges today. LastPass goes above and beyond to ensure security for all of their users. Your data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Your data is kept secret even from LastPass. Now, your master password and the keys used to encrypt the data are never sent to LastPass servers and are never accessible by LastPass. That's right. Now, as the gold standard, they engage trusted world-class third-party security firms to conduct routine audits and testing of their service and infrastructure. Honestly, I love this tool. I needed this tool. I need LastPass. I am a LastPass user for life. I love it. In fact, Twit uses LastPass Enterprise, and it recently has added peace of mind to our credential management. It really has made it easy for everybody here. You need LastPass for you and your business with their amazing features that will improve security across your company and make life easier for your users. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. That's LastPass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we have one more bite, and you know, we have a reliance on common useful apps, like for instance, Waze, Google Maps, and others, but should we actually be trusting these services? Well, it turns out if you're creative enough, you can use one of the most common childhood toys to make Google Maps display false real-time data. All you need is a little red wagon and 100 cheap smartphones. That's right. The little red wagon full of phones is the idea of a German artist, Simon Wickert, whose projects focus on what they call hidden layers in technology and examine the social and moral effects of the modern electronics-based lifestyle. Now, Google Maps determines congestion by gathering the location and motion of speed of phones in a given area. Now, generally speaking, those phones are given to be in the road because they are with drivers inside their vehicles, and so measuring the phone's speed is reasonably decent proxy for measuring vehicle speed. Now, those data points are then aggregated and make a road look green on the map if the track is seen moving smoothly, or they look red on the map if the traffic appears to be severe. Now, when traffic is severe, the map's navigation software will reroute drivers around the congestion when possible. Now, the crowdsourced data system more or less seems to work for millions of drivers. Obviously, it works for me every day. But unless, of course, you generate a whole bunch of deliberate incorrect data, adding entropy into the system, such as by piling 99 secondhand phones into a cart and moving at the speed of walking human between 2 and 4 miles per hour on an average rather than at the speed of even very slowly driving car. Now, then you can not only make a wide open road appear blocked, but you can keep it wide open even longer as cars reroute away from the supposed congestion. Yikes. Now, I'm going to throw this to Curtis first, because this isn't the first time we've seen GPS foiled. Do you think that our dependent on such services come from a sense of maybe false security here?
Well, I absolutely do, because we tend to believe that anything that comes over a radio signal is inherently more secure than the things that don't. And some of that is by design. You know, the government and the carriers have gone to extraordinary lengths to tell us that no one can listen in on our cell communications, that things are encrypted, that people can't pick up these radio transmissions. Some of that is true, and some of it's not. Radio, our cell, tends to be encrypted, but it is trivial to pick up signals on the frequencies. GPS is another one. It comes from the sky, therefore it must be reliable. And yet, we've seen any number of cases where it has been either jammed, in which case it simply becomes unusable, or spoofed, where it shows a location that isn't accurate. The most famous here being a number of ships in the Black Sea that suddenly found that their maps were reporting that they were about 50 miles inland. We need to treat all of this technology with the same level of healthy skepticism we do other things. We wouldn't trust our car speedometers if they showed we were going 20 miles an hour while we saw ourselves flashing past all of the cars on the street. We would know that something was wrong. We should be able to look at what's going on with the data we're receiving from this directional and other technology and say, hey, this doesn't seem right. And for now, I'm going to trust my own eyes and ears at least as much as the big magic direction finder from the sky.
Absolutely. Now, you talked a little bit about the user 2.0. Bam, I want to throw this to you because these types of services we have, we're reliant on these types of services. And again, like we talked about, we have some false security there. But these have some unintended consequences, right?
Yeah. I mean, not just the unintended consequences that Kurt alluded to there, which we saw in one of the many epic episodes of The Office when Michael Scott followed GPS straight into a pond. There are other unintended consequences like routing traffic through, you know, residential neighborhoods around common like rush hour areas. But imagine if somebody really, you know, again, the live free or die hard references in this episode, right? You're hacking the grid and creating, you know, traffic havoc that cuts off emergency services, right? So if someone wanted to, you know, have some nefarious master plan to, you know, make off with a bank heist, for example, could they reasonably block emergency services traffic by, you know, spoofing essentially traffic jams all over the city and forcing, forcing emergency services, you know, whether it's police or ambulances or what have you, from reaching where a crime or a disaster is occurring. These are you know, pretty dangerous things, and I'm actually struck by the parallels to the credential stuffing and the differentiation between, you know, a real user trying to log in and someone copying and pasting reused passwords from a previous breach. This is, again, this is about signal attenuation, right? What am I looking at? Is the data I'm taking in and publishing out actually good data, or is it noise, or is it intentional spoofing? So maybe, you know, we look to folks like Google or Waze to start to vet the sources of their data a little bit more and start to look for anomalies before they start advertising, these sort of specious reports of traffic jams. So, I think there's probably some work to be done there. Maybe there's a little cottage industry there that could be sold to Google in ways if you could figure out how to do that signal attenuation that would help us determine whether the data sources here are legitimate or not.
Curtis, I want to throw the last word to you. Again, we talk about unintended consequences. Is there some other option here?
Well, you know, I don't want to say that paranoia should run rampant, but I will say that I keep one of these. And I think that knowing how to use celestial navigation is one of those things that everyone should have in their hip pocket just in case. Between this and amateur radio and the Boy Scout compass I keep in my truck, I think I can generally get where I'm going even if the satellites fall from the sky.
Thanks, Curtis, the ultimate Boy Scout. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 Raspberry Pi Waze drivers. I do want to thank you guys for being here. As always, my co-host, Curtis Bam, enjoy RSA. I'm looking forward to hearing all about it. Curtis, where can folks find you? Where can they get in touch with you before RSA, maybe during RSA, and maybe read some of your stuff?
Well, you can always find my stuff to read at darkreading.com, and especially the section the Edge at Dark Reading. Little blue box right up on the nav bar. Go to the Edge. You'll find all kinds of interesting feature stories. Some of our 101, our technology explainers. Give it a shot. Let us know what you think. And as for me, I'm going to be reporting from RSA from beginning to end, both on the pages of Dark Reading and through my Twitter feed. You can find me there at KG4GWA.
Fantastic. Thank you, Curtis. We'll look forward to that coverage. Bam, we want to cover you as well. What, maybe, are you going to be really busy over there? Could you maybe hook up with some of the Riot, maybe? Or are you going to be too busy running around RSA? What's going on over there?
Well, I'm not going to be in RSA as long as Mr. Franklin. However, I will be there all day Tuesday and Wednesday. Swing by the F5 Networks booth. If I'm not there, mention that you're looking for me, and one of the fine folks there will certainly contact me, and I can triangulate and certainly glad to meet up with the Twilight Riot in person at RSA. So I'll be there Tuesday and Wednesday, and certainly, you know, swing by the booth. Learn more about F5, learn more about Shape Security, our new acquisition, which, not coincidentally, Shape Security is really, really effective at detecting credential stuffing attacks and fake users trying to take over accounts. So, definitely swing by the booth, look for me, or just talk to one of the even smarter people that are likely hanging around there who could teach you a thing or two about cybersecurity.
Thank you, sir. Well, guys, thanks so much for being here. I wouldn't want to do this show without you. Well, folks, I also want to thank you as well. You're the person that drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to catch up on your IT pro and enterprise news. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you will find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-hosts, the guest information, and the links that we do for those stories during the show. And more importantly, next to the videos, you'll actually get those really helpful subscribe and download links for your video. So support the show by getting your audio version, your video version, your HD video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices, and of course, any one of your podcast applications as well. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your members, your coworkers with sharing Twyatt with them as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available during the days, we also do this show live 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. That's right, on Fridays. You can watch the show live at live.twit.tv. We have a great cast of characters on the show. We do the behind the scenes, we do the before and after. Come watch the show live. Plus, if you're gonna watch the show live, I love our chat room. They are live there as well. We have a bunch of characters in there. We get some questions, we get some good content from them. Feel free to jump in there as well if you're gonna watch the show live. We really love having them there. And that's at irc.twit.tv. Now, if you can't watch the show live, then don't worry, because we still have a really great community. You can still be part of the discussion. That is twit.community. We have a great website out there. All the hosts are out there, the show content. We chat about each show. We chat about different technology that's going on. If you still want to join the discussion, definitely hang out over there. It's 24/7 discussion. It's a great set of people. It's the Twit Army. It's the Twilight Riot. Everyone's out there. Check it out, twit.community. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There you'll have all of my posts for enterprise tidbits, plus, of course, conversations with great people like you. Plus, you can see what I do during my normal work week here at Microsoft. And if you want to check out all of that I do here, go check out dev.office.com. There we post all of the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience and make it more profitable, actually more profitable and more portable for you, and more productive as well. In fact, go check out Office Scripts, one of our newest things that comes to Excel Online. It's a way to actually record macros and replay them that used to only be available in Windows. Now it's available across the web as well. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. We couldn't do this show without them, so thank you to them. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit, especially I want to thank our Mr. Brian Chi. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you for all of his support. And before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Victor. Victor, thank you for your support always. But in the spirit of tradition, we have to talk a little bit about the main theme of today's show. What was it? What do you think?
Well, other than security, but I think what we learned today was first of all, welcome back, Bam. But you never leave Twiat, and Twiat has an account with the guild, so they brought Bam back. And also with Curtis's navigation tools, nobody leaves Twiat. So
That's right. Nobody leaves Twiat. And and the only true Mandalorian is not Boba Fett. So that would definitely be the big one for today. But you were very close. Thank you, sir.
I knew I was on the right track.
Yeah, well, you're very close. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiat.